Hello and welcome to the Leadership Journey podcast. Each week, we give you the opportunity to reflect on some of the things that make up a leadership journey. My name is Alan Wilson, and I'm the host of the podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, and while you're there, you can leave us a review. Well, this is episode 26 of the Leadership Journey podcast, and this week, and in fact for the next 3 weeks, my guest is Malcolm Duncan. Malcolm has recently taken up the role of senior pastor in Dundonald Elam Church in East Belfast. And previously, most recently, he was the lead pastor of Gold Hill Baptist Church in England. Malcolm is also well known as a conference speaker at events such as New Horizon and Spring Harvest. In the first part of our conversation, Malcolm talks about returning home to Northern Ireland after being away for 30 years. He talks about his dramatic conversion experience as a teenager at school in Belfast. And he shares some of his thoughts on leadership and mentoring. Malcolm, welcome to the Leadership Journey podcast.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you, and thank you for your time. Malcolm, people will discern quite quickly that your accent is a Northern Irish accent, but yet you've lived quite a lot of time outside of the island.
Yeah, so I was born in Northern Ireland, born and brought up here in 1970, and I left toward the end of 1986.
So for university?
Yeah. Okay. So I went off to, when I left originally, I went to Mexico to work in an orphanage.
Right.
And then I went from there to Dundee to study. And I haven't lived here since. So I've just returned after almost 32 years of absence. I feel like an exile returning home.
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll probably talk about the process of how you came to make that decision to come back. But, I mean, just quickly, what are some of the things you've noticed in 30 years? Obviously, it's not that you were away entirely without ever visiting, but what are some of the things that have really jumped out at you coming back here?
I think I've come back to a different country, Alan. Yeah. I've come back to, in fact, not so long ago, after I'd made the decision to return to Northern Ireland, on one of the preparatory visits, I was sitting in a plane in Belfast Airport, ready to fly back to Heathrow, and I looked out the window on the right-hand side, and the hills of Belfast, the sun was setting, and the hills of Belfast were bathed in a golden light. And I could see Samson and Goliath, the mm-hmm. two cranes, caught in the silhouette. Mm-hmm. And I reflected, I left here as a 16-year-old young man, boy, and returned as a middle-aged man. Mm. I left single, I'm returning married. I left with no children, I returned with four adult children. Mm-hmm. I left with all of my family alive and have returned with 60% of them dead. I left a country where you had to open your bag or get searched to go into Belfast, and it was a ghost town at night. Mm-hmm. And I've returned to a vibrant European city full of life and vivacity. I left when there were UDR and police vans everywhere, and they're not so frequented on the streets now. So I've come back to a country which is completely different, yeah. Socially, culturally.
Spiritually?
Yes, and I think spiritually I've come back to a country that I'm still trying to find a spiritual geography for. Uh-huh. I think there's a great poem, and there's a line in it that says, old habits leap nomadic in the mind. Some of the things that I thought would have changed haven't. Some of the challenges of our spirituality are perhaps accentuated. Some of the prejudices are a little ingrained uh-huh. and will take a bit of time.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a different spiritual landscape, and yeah. I feel like I'm a novice climber at the bottom of a mountain.
Yeah, really. Yeah. So what are you noticing that's still here that maybe surprises you spiritually?
I think I still see a very strong subtext conversation around them and us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And given the processes of the last 32 years politically and sociologically, I think I expected some of that to be less evident. Mm-hmm. But it's a very, very, very almost subconsciously held perspective mm-hmm. that I've bumped into. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised at that. I'm surprised at the strength of feeling that I hear occasionally in that, particularly from some evangelicals.
Okay, right. And well, I think when you talk about as something that's so deeply held, it's almost subconsciously held, really. Maybe that was your word, I can't remember. But that's going to be very difficult to change then, isn't it?
Well, I would assume that you're looking at three or four generations mm-hmm. before those things begin to change. Mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that can help with that is For example, I had a conversation with a young person mm-hmm. who was 20 mm-hmm. Not so long ago, and said something about Northern Ireland, the Northern Ireland that I left. Mm-hmm. And they were born in 1999, so they were born the year after the Good Friday mm-hmm. Agreement. Mm-hmm. And it was their eyes glazed over. They kind of looked blankly at me. They simply did not have any personal recollection of some of the challenges that I grew up in. Bearing in mind, I was born the year the Troubles began, so I never knew Northern Ireland without it. It was just everything about Northern Ireland for me was determined or defined in some way by conflict.
Yeah.
And for them, it's a very different kind of conflict. Mm-hmm. It's a subtextual one, but it's still there.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, we'll probably come back to some of this stuff maybe in the second part of this interview, because I'd like to tease some of these things out a wee bit. But in terms of your journey, then sketch out a little bit, growing up Northern Ireland, Mexico, Dundee, what's happened in the intervening years then?
I was born in Rathcoole in Newton Abbey. I became a Christian when I was 16 from a non-Christian family.
Well, how did that happen?
I had a friend. I went to a school in central Belfast. I went to Inst.
Oh, right. Yeah. And is there not a story about you singing the school song of Inst with my nephew at New Horizon or something like that?
Oh, who's that?
His name is Mikey Wilson.
Yes, that's right. Inst, Inst, ancient and royal, Inst, great is thy name.
I think it's idolatrous, Malcolm.
I do too. We, thy sons, true and loyal, sing of thy glory and fame. RBAI, sing of thy glory and fame. The fact that that's ingrained, that I can't get it out of my mind, is something of a challenge. Yes, I remember that. So I went to Inst, and I had a friend there who was a Christian. His name was Graham Clark. And he invited me, when I was about 16, to go and hear somebody preaching outside Belfast City Hall one Friday afternoon in an open air. And I agreed to do that, just to shut him up, really. And I stood outside the old Robinson and Cleavers building with my back against the rounded window. Do you remember that section of it? Listening to the preacher. And I use these words advisedly because I've only heard, I think, an audible voice twice, but I believe of God. Mm-hmm. With my back against this window in Robinson and Cleavers, I heard a voice and it said, "Son, come home." And I knew it was God, but I didn't know why I knew or how I knew. Mm-hmm. And I can still hear the voice in my head. And it frightened me. I left the open air. I went back to school. Graham came up afterwards and said, "Did you enjoy that?" I said, "No, I'm never going to another one again. Don't ask me. Don't talk to me." Couldn't sleep at all on the Friday night. Was just under such a deep sense of God having said something to me. And I had an elderly aunt that attended a church. And I rang her on the Saturday morning. In fact, she was my father's aunt. She was my great aunt. And I said, "Do you mind if I come to church with you tomorrow night?" And she said, "No, not at all." So I went with her. She didn't turn up. She was sick. I sat in this church packed full of people and I heard a gospel message and avoided making any commitment to it. And coming out of the building, I had to come out of a foyer that was rammed full of people. And as I got to the door of the building about to leave, with one foot outside of it and one foot inside of it, the preacher shouted from the door of the sanctuary where he was welcoming and or saying goodbye to people. Mm-hmm. And he shouted across the room, the foyer, "Young man!" And of course, every young man turned around, but so did I. And he looked me straight in the eye and he pointed at me and he said, "Son, come home."
Oh.
Exactly the same words. Uh-huh. And in that moment, several things happened at once. I knew that I had to make a decision. And that if I decided not to follow Christ, then I would never make the decision. For some reason in my head, I knew this was the point I had to decide. And I also knew, and I don't know if this is normal, but it was for me, that if I decided to become a Christian, I would end up a pastor.
Mm.
So my conversion and my call happened at exactly the same moment. And I said yes, and turned and gave my life to Christ. And then I left Northern Ireland. I stayed around for about 9 months. I went to Mexico to work in an orphanage, discovered a passion for social justice there that I think it probably inherited from my dad and from my mum. Came back to study law in Dundee, was involved in planting a church further south in Scotland.
And, when you were at university?
Yeah. And eventually left the law degree, didn't finish it, and went down to get more involved in the church. And there I met my to-become wife, Debbie, who, interestingly enough, had been studying at Dundee the same time as me, but we never met. And about 6 months before we got married, About 6 weeks before we got married, we were talking about the fact that she'd been at Dundee and I'd been at Dundee at the same time, and we'd never met one another. And she had been going through a hard time and had been engaged and broken off the engagement and was living with depression. And one particular night, she said to the Lord, "I need you to help me. I can't get out of this." She went to a Christian Union meeting and heard a fella playing the clarinet, and she remembered the piece of music that he was playing, and God used it to minister to her and help her turn the corner. And it was me.
You were playing the clarinet?
And we never knew that until 6 weeks before we got married, four or five years later, 80, 90 miles south.
That's wonderful.
Ended up in Scotland. Anyway, I was in Falkirk for 5 or 6 years, and then went to study theology.
Were you pastoring the church in Falkirk? Or
no. The church was being pastored by somebody else, but I was part of the team that was helping to plant it and establish it and grow it.
Okay, so theology study, where did you do that?
Edinburgh and then Manchester.
Okay.
And I've been studying ever since.
Well, that's actually a good thing.
I'm never going to get to the end of it.
No, of course not.
I feel as if I've been studying theology for 30 years, and I understand God less than I've ever understood him, but love him more than I've ever loved him.
Lovely.
So that's probably a good
balance. Understand
him
less than ever, but
love him more
than ever. That's a wonderful way.
I don't need to understand God to trust him. Yeah. I've learned that over the years.
Yeah. Okay. So after study, was there a path into some kind of vocational ministry then?
Yes. So my theological study, because I'd been so involved in the church in Falkirk, and as I'd said, I knew the night that I became a Christian that I was going to end up doing what I'm doing now. I was always waiting for the right opportunity in the right moment. And when that arose, I went to study in Edinburgh, then went to study in Manchester, and took on the responsibility of pastoring a church whilst studying as part of a placement, and then stayed there and continued to help them. And that was 1994, 1995. Mm-hmm. And I have continued pastoring ever since then. Mm-hmm. I've never not pastored a church since then.
Yeah, so where all have you been pastoring?
So helped with the church plant in Scotland, but wasn't on the pastoral staff there. Then I was in Cheshire in a little... I was placed in a little Baptist United Reformed Church combination called Market Street. From there, I was placed in a church in Audlem in Cheshire for a couple of years. Tiny little Baptist church. Loved it. Saw a wonderful bunch of people. From there, I went to Yeovil, where I worked for a year deliberately to help in an Elam church, because by then I'd become an Elam minister. From there, I went to Bournemouth, where I was for almost 10 years, the pastor of a church in a place called Springbourne. Mm-hmm. From there, I went to London as a director of the Evangelical Alliance and planted a church whilst there. Then from there, we moved to Reading, and got involved in a church in a rural context, which I'd never done before. Pastored it for 3.5 or 4 years as a volunteer, and then with a little bit of financial support. And then from there, I went to Gold Hill in Buckinghamshire, where I was for 8 years.
Was Gold Hill not a Baptist church?
Yeah.
Yeah,
Gold Hill is a Baptist church.
So you've kind of moved...
So there's an interesting story there. Yeah, there is an interesting story. So when I was at Bible College, because I had... I went up to university... Because I was doing my training in a seminarian-type context as well, I was placed in a Baptist church, but the college that I was studying in, part of Manchester University, was also affiliated to the Elam Church. And on the same day, both the Baptist Union and the Elam Church offered me accreditation. And I remember the conversation very clearly, because what happened was... The Baptist church said, "We will place you in Audlem, this little church that I'd been in, and you'll stay there, and we'll fund you to do your PhD, and we'll support you. That will be your route into ministry." And Elam asked me to become an accredited minister. Both offered me accreditation.
Did you toss a coin?
No, I felt like that.
I'll tell you, actually, somebody else that I interviewed in this podcast a while back.
Did toss a coin?
Yeah, tossed a coin between two denominations.
Amazing.
When he didn't get when he tossed it the first time. You know, it was heads, I'm going to be this, tails, I'm going to be that. And when he tossed it the first time and realised he didn't want to be what it was supposed to be, he said, "Okay, best of three." He's now a bishop.
Oh, wow. Well, what happened with me was I had said, my wife and I talked about it. I said, "I don't know what to do." I said, "I feel a tug toward Elam." And my wife, Debbie, said to me, well, say yes to that. And if God wants you to end up pastoring in a Baptist church as well, he'll do that. Wow. And that's exactly what he did. So almost 20 years later, I find myself in a situation. I've pastored in an Elam church. I've pastored in a Countess of Huntingdon Connection church, which is a tiny little reformed tradition that grew out of Methodism in the 1750s. I've pastored in a Baptist church, and I'm now pastoring in an Elam church again. But I've been an accredited Elam minister for 24 years.
So are you a guy that doesn't really fit into a theological, a neat theological category?
Probably.
Certainly not a neat denominational category.
Probably. Yeah. I think denominations are helpful and a blessing insofar as they are used to facilitate the advancement of the kingdom of God. The moment they become our primary definers, I think they're dangerous things.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Looking back sort of to the earlier formative stages of life, where would some of your main influences have come? Who are some of the people who stand out that really had a big input into your life?
Theologically or in terms of leadership?
Probably both.
Well, theologically, I think I very quickly discovered a rather eclectic range of voices that were speaking into my heart, many of them long since dead, and I quickly discovered that one can be mentored and shaped by people who are no longer on earth. So people like Charles Spurgeon, C.S. Lewis, Francis Schaeffer had a very profound influence on my theological convictions. John Calvin, Martin Luther, Philip Melanchthon, Ulrich Zwingli, some of those voices were very powerful. But as were early desert fathers, you know, Gregory and Anna and desert mothers as well, obviously. Some of those began to have a very powerful and profound influence on me in terms of theological conviction. In terms of, I've always found myself in a rather odd position because my theological and ecclesiological convictions around leadership mean that I firmly believe in a kind of principle of eldership and the conviction that the Spirit abides within the body of the church. And when we are listening to him, we listen to him together. So I'm rather at odds with the idea of solo leadership. In fact, we may pick it up later. In many ways, I think solo leadership borders on being rather demonic if it's exercised incorrectly. And I know that's strong language.
It is strong language, yeah.
But I'm happy to explain what I mean by that.
So okay,
that
why don't you do that? Talk about it now.
Okay. So for me, one of the inherent principles of God's character and God's essence is that he is an eternal community where there is eternal voluntary mutual submission.
Right.
So the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are involved in what the Eastern Orthodox Church would call an eternal dance. The perichoresis of always submitting to one another, always loving one another, always honouring one another, and always putting one another first. And that creates the most beautiful and profound community out of which leadership flows and life flows. The antithesis of that is isolated and cut off leadership where there is no need to consult and there's no need to be accountable and there's no need to be in community. And that is the kind of leadership that I see exercised by Satanas, by Satan, by Beelzebub, by Lucifer, by whatever you call him in scripture. However he appears, he always appears in solitariness. He always appears in isolation. And when he attacks people or draws them into wrong thinking, he does so by a primary methodology of isolating them. So he isolates Christ in the wilderness. He isolates Christ in the garden. That sense of isolation you hear when you read some of Paul's writing around struggles with leadership and decision making. And therefore, I think that solo leadership that is never accountable, never willing to listen and never willing to dialogue is a personification of that.
Wow, that's very powerful. Very powerful. And, you know, the sort of a much deeper theology of team leadership, really, than is often talked about, I think.
Well, I think so. And I think partly, whether I'm right or wrong, so back to the influences for me, the influencing voices for me around leadership are not necessarily the voices of that speak of solitary leadership or portray leadership in the Christian community or in life as kind of being a modern day Moses or a modern day Joshua or a modern day this or a modern day that. They are the voices of those people that, and I guess some people would call them Presbyterian or forms of leadership, the voices of William Still and so forth, who argue for or advocate for a form of leadership that is accountable and open and in community. I think some of the great examples of community-led leadership we get from things like Vineyard and from some of the new church movements. Mm-hmm. And the best bishops that I've met are bishops who listen well and build a team around them. Mm-hmm. They're not people that argue that they're not leaders, mm-hmm. and they don't abdicate responsibility for making hard decisions, mm-hmm. but they default toward a place where they will lead in community, and where there's a difficult decision and they can't get consensus, then they're going to have to make a decision. Mm-hmm. But they never default to making the decision and looking for approval.
Right.
They default to listening and talking it through and making a decision together.
Yeah.
And I think that creates a much healthier approach to leadership. My challenge, I think, is looking around my contemporaries and looking around the leadership world that I see, not just in church, but particularly in church, it's less so in business, is we almost argue for team leadership because it has a Machiavellian kind of pragmatic thing. It's better to lead in team. Whereas I think there's a principle of leading in team that we need to own first. Mm-hmm. Because there will be times when it's not better to lead in team. It's easier to lead alone, but it's not better to lead alone.
Yeah, but that's driven by a deeper principle that you've thought through.
If one has an ideological conviction about it, then when you are pulled toward the pragmatic decision of it's easier to do this on my own, there's a deeper anchor that holds you in, but I mustn't.
Yeah.
Because there are dangers of making decisions on your own, I think, that we often ignore until it's too late.
Yeah. Okay. That's excellent. Great. Tell me about mentors. Were there mentors who, you know, you've talked about people, okay, guys who'd lived in previous centuries who mentored you through their writings. Did you know William Still? You wouldn't have known William Still.
I met William Still personally on a number of occasions. Okay. I didn't. I wouldn't go as far as saying that I knew him.
Yeah.
But he certainly inputted into my life.
Okay.
In terms of mentors for me, in the formative years of my Christian life, it was quite difficult to find people to speak into my life because the context was really one of not having that. But
very. Do you mean it just nobody thought of doing it?
Nobody thought of doing it, or nobody wanted to give it the time, because there were busier things, there were better things that they could do, like reaching the unchurched and building the church and getting more people into the congregation. Personally, I think there's nothing better than investing in other people, but that's not the culture that I was converted into. And ironically, some of those people became mentors and friends in the years that subsequently flowed out of that. But there were people who took an interest in me. There was a guy called John Lancaster, who is now almost 100, a shining light in Elam, one of the greatest preachers in Elam's history. And in my early years in pastoral ministry, he took a real interest in me. And he would phone me and ask me how I was and encourage me and prayed for me and give me advice. He was always at the end of the phone. John Smith, who was the principal of the Elam Bible College in the mid-1990s, was very helpful and influential for me. A guy called John Glass, who led Elam up until very recently, had a very profound influence in my life. And then there were other people that...
How did that happen? Was that in like regular meetings or...
Some of them was regular meetings, some of them was telephone conversations, some of them was by correspondence.
Yeah.
Some of them were ad hoc meetings as and when issues arose.
How did they come about? Did you ask these people to mentor you, or did they say, here's a guy that we want to invest in?
A bit of both.
Yeah.
It just depended. I mean, it's my approach to mentoring now is I tend to look for people and offer them my help and support, or they'll have a conversation with me about it.
Okay. So I'm just going to ask you, if you're speaking, say, to two different people here, younger leader who's saying, I wish I had a mentor.
Yes.
Older leader who's saying, I'd love to mentor someone, I don't know how to go about it. What would you say to each of them?
Well, I would say, first of all, that everybody needs to have what I describe as a Timothy and Paul principle. Mm. So all of us should have a Timothy that we're investing in and a Paul that's investing in us. Mm. It's easy to remember and it's simple. And you immediately create a Trinitarian community because there are three of you involved, which I think is reflective of the Godhead. So to the older person looking for somebody to mentor, it might be a little bit controversial, but I would say to them, well, who first are you willing to be accountable to? I will not anybody mentor me who's not willing to be mentored. Because if somebody says to me, I want to speak into your life, but nobody's speaking into mine, then that's the top of that accountability tree.
Yeah.
And as far as I'm aware, the top of the accountability tree should really be God himself. And there's no human that has that authority.
Yeah.
And the delegated authority of 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, the kephale authority,
yeah.
always flows in accountable relationship.
Yeah.
So I would never let anybody... If somebody's looking... If somebody wants to mentor somebody else,
mm-hmm.
I would be saying to them, you're not ready to mentor somebody else unless you're willing to be mentored.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody wanting to be mentored by somebody else, I would say to them, so what are you going to do with this? Are you willing to mentor someone else?
Right, so you're pushing both in us out beyond
exactly.
the relationship.
Yeah. Exactly. Uh-huh. And then, realistically, honestly, now, maybe I am, my capacity is rather stunted or limited, but I don't think I can mentor any more than three or four people properly
mm-hmm.
if it's going to be a long-term commitment. So if somebody's looking for a mentor, I would be saying to them, who is... further along in the faith, who do you look at and think, I want to be like them? Who do you see authenticity in? Who do you see who is vulnerable enough to admit when they get it wrong and bold enough to celebrate when they get it right? Who do you listen to and you can hear in their voice and in their and see in their lives a broader range of theological conviction than you're comfortable with? Who pushes you beyond your theological boundaries and forces you to think differently and explore things differently? And then have a conversation with them about whether or not mentoring from them is A, possible, and B, practical.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible if they're willing to do it. It's practical if you can make it work. And almost have an informal learning contract with them.
Mm-hmm.
What does you mentoring me mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Does it mean that we're going to meet every 6 weeks? Does it mean that we'll have a Skype call? Will we ever get away together?
Mm-hmm.
Can we do retreat together? What levels mm-hmm. are you going to speak into my life? Am I going to give you permission to mm-hmm. speak into my life? And how is that going to look on paper? And let's sketch it out for the first 6 months
mm-hmm.
and then review it
mm-hmm.
and see if it's going to be workable.
That's terrific. That's really rich, Malcolm. Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about some of the main turning points maybe in your life. For example, moving here to Northern Ireland, and I don't think we said this, you know, since we've been talking, but we are sitting in your office in Dundonald,
yes.
Dundonald Elam. And since we don't, since there are no photographs of this office...
It's a rather transitional office, don't
you think? Describe it. Transitional is a good way to put it.
It's halfway to being a wonderful space to work in.
Yeah, it looks like it'd be great.
It will. The guys have worked really hard on it, but we're surrounded by boxes. We have desks that need replaced. And furniture that doesn't fit. It's a bit like my life at the moment.
Okay.
It's a good metaphor of being exiting one place and coming into another.
Okay. Well, how many times have you had those major transitions?
Not many. I think there was a major transition for me in choosing after I was converted to not return to Northern Ireland. That was a very important decision. That would have been 1987.
Why did you make that decision?
Because I was so fundamentally committed to serving in the local church plant that I was involved in, I felt that it demanded my attention and time.
Mm-hmm. Was there any tug at that point? Or did anybody approach you and ask you to come back? And
my family disowned me because I wouldn't come back. My brother, who is now dead...
He was a journalist?
He was a journalist, yeah. Loved him very much. Colin was his name.
Mm.
The night that I told him that I wasn't returning, put his... fist through the door beside my head. And I think one can be very quick to condemn or judge decisions or priorities like that from your family. I think what I've come to understand is I was the first in my family to go to university. Their hopes and aspirations were pinned on me vicariously. I was going to be the lawyer. I was going to be the one that did this, X and Y. And to a certain extent, I had put those aspirations on myself. I was going to prove that I could come from where I came from and do whatever I was going to do. And when God drew me into his care and I became a Christian, my whole life changed.
Mm.
Every priority was turned upside down. Everything was changed. Mm. So when I then made a decision that flowed out of those priority paradox moments that had... So the paradigmatic shifts in my worldview, it was unfair and unwise of me to expect an unconverted family to understand that all I was doing was working out the paradigmatic shifts in my worldview.
Sure.
So that was a very, very, very difficult time.
Mm-hmm. It must have been incredibly painful.
It was, yeah.
And obviously you're called, you felt you were called to something, but there's that pain. And dare I say that maybe it's something that you probably only realised more fully with time?
Oh, I still think I still am only realising it. I think, I mean, the story of my conversion is one in which I exited my earthly family and had to find a family in Christ. And it took years and years. It still does. Still does. I think I'm unpeeling the layer of that onion and discovering my identity in Christ as I go on. Mm. And the richness and the depth and the security of it is something that I don't think I'll ever get to the bottom of this side of eternity. Mm. So I think those choices were very difficult. I think they were perhaps made naively. Would I make them the same way? Would I make the same choices? It's the million dollar question. What does the 48-year-old self say to the 17-year-old self? I think the choices that I made were the right ones. I think the way I made them was probably unkind.
Yeah.
And I think that I was more unkind to my family than they were to me because I didn't give them time to think through the choices that I was making.
Yeah, and I suppose there's something when you feel God has broken into your life and God is calling you, and presumably at that stage you thought you were going to change the world, or Mexico at least. And, you know, so who
do you know? Do you know, honestly, deep down inside of me, I still want to change the world. Yeah. I don't mean Malcolm Duncan wants to change the world, but I think I'm part of the movement called the Church that is the biggest changer of the world that history has ever seen. And I haven't lost my call it naivety or innocence or barefaced faith, I don't know what it is, or presumption. I don't ever want to lose that influence.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was one big turning point for me. Another was deciding to get married in the early 1990s. And my wife and I, then one person's decision became two people's decisions for the rest of our lives. And they have been very, very, very powerful moments. The decision to leave the church in Yeovil in 1996... going into 1997 was a big decision, which was foisted upon me because of a challenge around some of the behaviours of the leadership team, or the one person in particular whose identity I'll protect. But it was a very difficult, very profoundly difficult time for us. The leadership team of the church at the time, I felt that I needed to resign because one of my colleagues was behaving in a way that I just couldn't respect. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe in rebellion. Mm-hmm. I think biblically there's never a case for rebellion. There's a case for honest confrontation and dialogue and conversation, but there comes a point when you have to make a decision. Yeah. I can work with you and respect you, or I can't respect you any longer, therefore I can't work with you.
Yeah.
But what I'll never do is undermine you and run and tittle-tattle behind your back. And I remember the night that I resigned. I'll not go into the details of why I did, because the church leadership team resigned with me and asked me to plant a church in the same town. And I refused because I said then, and I still believe, I will never split a church.
Mm-hmm.
I will never be the source of a new church in a town at the risk of destroying the church that I pastored.
Wow, right.
And actually, I didn't realise how many times that decision would come back to for me to make a same principle decision on and advising other churches that are going through things like that, or ending up pastoring churches that are going through things like that.
Yeah.
But it was a very, very powerful moment deciding that my wife and I, Debbie had just had our third child, Anna, making a decision that we would put our family into a state of precariousness and step into unknownness to protect the body of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And we would trust that God would look after our two young boys and our little girl. Mm-hmm. And he did.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the right decision to make. For the right reasons, but it was a very difficult decision.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next big turning point was 7 or 8 years into my leadership in Bournemouth. We were coming home from church one Sunday morning, and Debbie said to me, my wife, Malcolm, I think it's time for you to move. And I loved the church in Bournemouth. And I said, why is that? And she said, because I don't think that the church is any longer following you.
Huh. Was that a surprise to you?
It wasn't a surprise to me.
Would you verbalise it if she hadn't verbalised it?
No.
Yeah.
No. She had more acuity and more clarity in seeing that than I did, because I was too close to it.
Yeah.
I never stopped loving that church.
Mm-hmm.
But she was right, and it was time to move. I've subsequently discovered something, and this perhaps this jumps right to my decision to return to Northern Ireland. I don't think, Alan, that I'm not sure this is a universal truth. I have a feeling that it might be. But talking about pastoral leadership for a moment, or leading of a team, mm-hmm. whatever that team might look like, in business or in the home or in work or in church, I don't think, as a pastor, I can lead people that I don't love.
Mm-hmm.
So when I mm-hmm. make a decision to become the leader of a community that invites me to lead them, like I did here or in Gold Hill, I put my hand into my chest and I take my heart out and I give it to that community. Mm-hmm. And I say, in order to lead you, I have to love you. And to love you, I have to trust you with my heart. You can kick it up and down the aisles. You can stab it. You can stamp on it. And some of you will. But I can't preach to you. I can't pastor you. And I can't lead you unless I love you. And on the day that I stop loving you, I will have to stop leading you, because I will become a driver rather than a leader and a pastor. And the other thing that I think is very important is, and it's something I find very hard to articulate, but I have discovered, I think, in my own life, that in order to lead a community, I always have to be slightly uneasy with them.
What do you mean?
I can't become so like them, uh-huh. spiritually or in terms of outlook, that their worldview becomes mine. There has to be a creative tension,
right,
between the community that you're leading and you.
So when you say uneasy with them, you mean you can't be fully comfortable with them?
Yes,
right.
That's exactly what I mean.
Okay.
I mean that I can love them, I can enter into full relationship with them, I can give myself to them, mm-hmm. but I'm always yearning for something else.
Right.
I always have to see round the curve.
Yeah.
And I have people, I'm sure you've had this experience, people often will say to me, I want you to pray that my frustration will go away. I want you to pray that I'll not feel as uneasy as I do now in this position. And I will say to them all the time, I am not praying that for you. Because if you ask me to pray your frustration away, I can pray that it's channeled, I can pray that it's focused, I can pray that it's directed. But if I pray that it goes, that I'm praying your leadership away.
So I love
and I'm grateful to God for the privilege of stepping into this new leadership role here at Dundonald. There will always have to be a creative tension between where the congregation is and, honestly, where the staff team is, mm-hmm. and where you are if you are the lead pastor.
Mm-hmm.
Because that space can either be a magnet that draws people on. You know, when you were little and you got two magnets, mm-hmm. and if you got the right poles facing each other, they attracted.
Mm-hmm.
But if you got them the wrong way, mm-hmm. they pushed.
Yeah.
So I think bad leadership gets them the wrong way and pushes them apart.
Mm-hmm.
I think okay leadership
mm-hmm.
gets them the right way and pulls them together.
Mm-hmm.
I think healthy leadership gets them the right way around and always leaves a tiny little space so that one magnet is being drawn by the other.
Yes. That's vivid. That's a very vivid picture of it. That's great. That's
so
great.
That little space.
Yeah.
Is the frustration, yeah. the challenge, the tension.
So what's the balance? There's a fine balancing act here, where you've got this unease or slight discomfort or not full comfort with the people you're leading, and yet this total surrender of your heart to them. How do you get the balance between those so that you're not tilting too much in the direction of the creative tension, nor are you tilting too far in the direction of just assimilation?
Well, that's the balance between, in local church leadership, that's the balance between being prophetic and being a pastor.
Because
the pastor will always draw you back, the prophetic will always draw you forward.
Okay, or there's something to tease out. Do you know what, Malcolm? We're going to have to stop at this point, so we're going to come back next time, and we're going to tease out more on this prophetic and pastoral thing, okay? Because it's too rich just to consign it to a footnote, and since we don't have footnotes on the podcast, well, we do. We've got some notes on the podcast, but this is more than a footnote, so we'll come back to it. So thank you, and we'll look forward to picking this up next time.
Great, it's great to have the conversation with you.
Thank you. Well, thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Leadership Journey podcast, and thanks to Malcolm Duncan for talking to us. Next week, Malcolm will be back. We'll be talking some more about leadership. And Malcolm will be sharing some of the ways that he sensed God calling him back to Ireland.
So make sure to be back next week for the next part of Malcolm's story. And in the meantime, have a good week and God bless you.